Internationally famous Pabst Blue Ribbon, finest beer served anywhere, presents The Life of Riley, starring William Bendix as Riley.
We are going to get a lesson this hour in broadcasting, advertising, and cultural history from the author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. And just to clarify, Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer is not an underwriter of this program. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, December 10th. Old-time radio fans may remember some of the clips we will be playing this hour, and I hope you will join in with your memories and questions and maybe some examples of how you may still hear or see the role of advertising in broadcasting today. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Cynthia Myers, an associate professor of communication at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York City. She is author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So when was the Golden Age of Radio?
Oh, I would say the 30s and 40s, but radio really gets started in the 20s. It becomes a big fad, sort of like the internet of the 1920s, and everybody wants to get on the radio.
Yeah. Well, and why is it called the Golden Age? It was so much better then?
Well, I think it's the Golden Age because that's when it was the central medium. It was before television. So people turned to radio not only to hear news and music, but that's also where they found drama, comedy, game shows, variety shows. And all of that programming moved to television in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
But during the 30s and 40s, radio was all live for the most part. And it's really when national networks developed, when people could tune in anywhere in the country and hear, you know, a famous comedian or a famous actor.
And one of the points you make in your book is that radio would not have had a golden age without advertising.
Exactly, because when radio got started in other countries, they decided to have the government support programming and pay for it. But here in the United States, they wanted it to be a commercial enterprise. And broadcasters realized that it cost them a lot of money to provide programming. And so they turned to advertisers to help pay for that programming. And part of what my book is really about is how the advertisers then were in charge of all the entertainment in the Golden Age of radio. And because they were in charge of the entertainment, they were paying for it, they were selecting it, they were casting it. They were trying to also combine entertainment with advertising. And so my book is really about how all these different advertisers and their agencies came up with different strategies to try to appeal to radio audiences.
Yeah, interesting. So the advertisers were, in essence, the producers of all the entertainment programming.
Exactly. And today we see that beginning to happen again because advertisers realize that a lot of people are skipping the TV commercials when they watch on their DVR. So they're beginning to go back to integrating more and more of their advertising into the actual entertainment.
Yeah. I can tell that some of our listeners who are fans of non-commercial broadcasting mm-hmm. might think, boy, is that really a good thing that that advertisers are, in essence, in control of the content?
Well, you know, I think that's a really, really good question and a really good point. And actually, a lot of people at the time were very concerned about it. There were a lot of objections to advertiser control of programming. The consumer movement objected to it. And in fact, there were lots of debates in Congress about this. But one of the ways that this system continued and commercial radio thrived was that the broadcasters claimed that, you know, they had First Amendment rights, and that the advertisers were helping support a free and open media. And then the advertisers and their agencies liked the claim that what they were doing was they were trying to bring what audiences wanted to them. And they could afford to do that because they're the ones who had the money. So instead of taxpayers paying for Jack Benny, they were saying, well, Jell-O is going to pay for Jack Benny. And in return for Jell-O paying for Jack Benny, they hoped that audiences would be grateful for that, and that gratitude then would spill over into audiences wanting to buy that product. So actually, in the 20s, there was so much concern that audiences would be upset at advertisers using radio, but they only used indirect advertising. That is, they just sponsored the program, and they chose music, and they labeled the program with their brand. So, for example, the Clico Club, which is a ginger ale company, they sponsored a program called Clico Club Eskimos, which was a band which played Eskimo music, including barking sled dogs.
Well, let's take a listen. To the Clico Club clip that we have.
Perky and poppy that music is.
I like it, yeah. And it's got a little bit of the, you know, the little barking dog there. Now was, go ahead.
So the idea was that people would associate that perky music with the bubbly ginger ale. So when radio first started being used by advertisers, they just tried to create an association between the entertainment and the brand. And they didn't come on the radio and say, buy our ginger ale, because they were afraid they would alienate listeners.
And did people buy their ginger ale?
I think so. They were successful enough that other advertisers started getting interested in radio. And that's really actually why the national networks developed. NBC was the first national network established in 1926. And they got established in part because they wanted to be able to coordinate this for advertisers so that they could get their message or their program out to multiple cities at the same time, which would make it possible for radio to be a national advertising medium instead of just a local medium. So, but once the Depression came along, advertisers wanted to be able to make sure their message was heard. And so what happened instead was they started doing what was called hard sell, which was they would make claims about the product. They'd give you all sorts of information about the product. They'd repeat it over and over again, and in part because they were worried that audiences wouldn't understand. This was a new medium, a new technology. They weren't sure if audiences were paying attention. And so hard sell advertising came to radio. And so when advertisers and sponsors put together programs, they often also included pretty long commercials. They were often 2 minutes long because they were afraid it would take that long for the audiences to understand. And then they would also apply the idea of the selling strategy to the program itself. So one of the top hard sell agencies was a company called Blackett Sample Hummert, and they produced a lot of radio soap operas, all those daytime serials like Ma Perkins, Just Plain Bill, The Romance of Helen Trent, Stella Dallas, and each one of the programs, the actual program, was also constructed like the ad.
Yeah, let's take a listen to, we have a clip of Ma Perkins, I believe Oxidol was sponsoring this. Hold on.
Which is a laundry soap.
And here's Oxidol known Ma Perkins again, the true life story of a woman whose life is the same, whose surroundings are the same, whose problems are the same as those of thousands of other women in the world today. And remember that even your best cotton print and your children's baby frocks are safe in mild, thick Oxidol suds because it embodies a new discovery which keeps all the fast-washing and wipe-washing qualities in the soap.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy to hear it, perhaps, but but if we use Oxidol, we'll get our socks white.
Yeah, so in that commercial that goes on for about 2 minutes, they talk about the science behind it. They talk about how clean it gets your clothes, how good it is for your hands, how your whites will be whiter, your brights will be brighter. So in the hard sell, they make lots of product claims, and they called it the reason why strategy, where they give you lots and lots of reasons why to buy. So if one reason why didn't appeal to you, then the other one would. And Ma Perkins is one of the most popular soap operas, and these soap operas were often criticized for being really long-winded and repetitious, and, you know, the stories would take, you know, weeks and months to develop.
That's still the same.
But it was actually the advertising strategy, because they believed that audiences needed to hear, you know, the same plot point over and over again in order to understand it, and they assumed that housewives were distracted when they were listening. So sometimes when people criticize this golden age of radio, this kind of pedantic, ponderous, slow drama, what they're really criticizing is the hard sell radio advertising strategy, which is to repeat it, repeat it, and repeat it again.
We are talking about the evolution of advertising, especially when it applies to the golden age of radio. We're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your examples. We're welcoming perhaps even your memories of how advertisers were the producers of the golden age of radio. And maybe you're hearing this or seeing this today. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Internationally famous Pabst Blue Ribbon, finest beer served anywhere, presents The Life of Riley, starring William Bendix as Riley.
We are talking with the author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. And we're welcoming your questions about this, and we're welcoming any examples you might have from then or from now about how advertisers are influencing the content of broadcasting. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Cynthia Myers. She's the author of A Word from Our Sponsor and an associate professor of communication at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York City. I replayed the Pabst Blue Ribbon example that I had. I remember actually in the not so golden age of television, they were Pabst Blue Ribbon would sponsor, for example, a segment of sports in one of our local markets. This was in Wausau, and the sportscaster would actually pour a glass of Pabst Blue Ribbon live during the broadcast. Cynthia Myers.
Yes. Well, sponsorship has never really fully gone away. But the golden age of radio was when most programs were sponsored. So we've always had a few programs sponsored. And the golden age of television in the 1950s is when most of the television programs were also sponsored. And what happens in the history of sponsorship is that sponsors have to come up with different strategies and different ways of pleasing to listeners, and different ways of demonstrating the product, like you just described, pouring the beer on Maxwell House coffee. They had a show called Showboat, and they would pour coffee into cups and stir it, and then the cast members would have a coffee break in the middle of the show, you know, backstage. So they were coming up with all sorts of strategies to try to attract audiences and interest them in the product.
I want to talk about another. This reminded me of another soap opera because it was sponsored by Ivory Soap, and and this is an example that that you gave us that is integrated advertising. Let's take a listen to this clip from, I think this is the Gibson family.
Yes, it's the Gibson family, which was a very short-lived kind of serial romantic comedy musical.
Let's take a listen.
And now, before the overture to the second act of The Gibson Family, let's step backstage and look in on Sally Gibson and Hilda, her maid, who is helping Sally change for the next scene.
Quick, Hilda, hold this dress. I've never been so excited in all my life.
It's really wonderful, isn't it, Miss Sally?
Too wonderful. That scene in the garden.
It made me think of Henry, Miss Sally. Miss Sally, if I had your complexion, do you suppose Henry would...
What, Hilda?
Help me, what's wrong with my face, Miss Sally? Those red blotches just won't go away.
Soap, probably. What kind are you using? Some beauty soap, I suppose.
Yes, Miss Sally. That one that promises radiant beauty, glamorous youth, irresistible loveliness.
Hilda, you can't feed the pores of your skin with beauty oils or mysterious ingredients.
No.
And many highly perfumed, prettily colored soaps contain fatty acids and free alkali that really irritate and harm your skin.
But, Miss Sally...
My doctor recommended Ivory. He says all any soap can do is cleanse, and that to protect the fine texture and pores, a soap should cleanse gently. And that to do that, a soap must be pure. He said Ivory would help to keep my skin smooth and fine.
And Miss Sally, do you think Henry would...
Oh, quick, my gloves, Hilda. Is the bell for the second act?
No, Hilda will never get a Grecian nose by using a beauty soap. But we do hope she gets Henry. And now for the overture to our second act. All right, Don.
Oh, my goodness. So that was an ad, but it was a scene from the radio show.
Right. The maid was asking for beauty advice from one of the main characters. And she's told that Ivory soap will help her love life. this strategy is coming back using characters from programs in the actual commercial. And Target is doing this right now on ABC. The three sitcoms, The Middle, Modern Family... different characters from those sitcoms are interacting with each other during a commercial during those actual programs. Oh, and the other sitcom is back in the game. So, for example, one commercial shows the character Sue from the sitcom The Middle, and she's playing with the dog from the show with Modern Family. Advertisers want to do this because they know that viewers are tuning out, they're not paying attention, and that if the audience suddenly sees a character on the screen, they'll think, wait, is this the program again? And then when they realize that there's characters from several programs, in this case that Target is trying, then they'll pay even more attention. What's going on? What's happening in this brave new world of sitcoms when characters leave their sitcom and start interacting with other sitcom characters. So the Target's really hoping that audiences will be intrigued and interested, and then also, of course, have a favorable attitude towards Target.
Yeah. And so did the Gibson family, every time it was time for an ad, come up with some other little scenario where the benefits of Ivory soap could be discussed?
Yes, actually, it was sponsored by Procter & Gamble, and this is a case where most of the, Oxydol was a Procter & Gamble brand. Most of the time, Procter & Gamble would just have one product per program, because they were trying to make sponsor identification between the specific product and a specific program. But every once in a while, they would experiment and use more than one product in a program. So in the Gibson family, they actually also did some commercials and some scenes about some other Procter & Gamble products as well. But that show actually was canceled pretty quickly because it was too expensive. However, other shows like the Maxwell House Showboat Hour very regularly did cast commercials, but they were usually, instead of being so integrated into the narrative, they were more like backstage breaks. Oh, by the way, long break. And, what are you drinking?
Maxwell House.
What kind of coffee is that?
Yeah. Well, it seems it's a little different, but with just a minute or so before a news break, is this almost like a product placement in a TV show or a movie today?
It's similar. However, with product placement, there's a producer in the network, and they control the program, and then they get paid money by the advertiser to place the product in the scene. And advertisers have used that for a long time. It's happened in movies all the way throughout the history of movies. But advertisers started feeling like that wasn't strong enough or compelling enough. And so this integration of the cast and the narratives into with the advertising, I think, is going to be it's a more powerful tool for the advertisers. And I think they're going to start using that even more. They're going to continue to use product placement, but I think they're going to want to integrate the actual story and characters even more.
We are talking with Cynthia Myers. She's an associate professor of communication at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York City. And she is author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. And we are taking a look back into the past and exploring the impact of advertising on the golden age of radio and how that impact is still audible and visible today. And we're welcoming any examples or questions that you have. We'll check news and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Someone once said that the world stands aside to make way for the man who knows where he's going. And so tonight it gives me great pleasure to make way for a man who knows what he's talking about.
We are talking about advertising and the golden age of radio and how what happened then influenced what we hear and see today. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 6:37 on this Tuesday, December 10th. Our guest is the author of A Word from Our Sponsor, and we're remembering how advertising was used in radio broadcasting back in the 20s through the 40s, and how advertisers were so involved in putting together radio entertainment programs, and how all this applies to media today. And we welcome your questions, your memories, your modern examples. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Maybe you recall some of the ads and sponsorships of the past. Maybe you're noticing ads and sponsorship of the present, too. Let me welcome back our guest, Cynthia Myers, an associate professor of communication at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York City, the author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio. Here's an email from Jack in La Crosse. He writes, 40 years ago, I heard a talk from a legendary radio ad man, Chuck Blore. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly. B-L-O-R-E. About creating radio ads. He said, in the commercial, if you have something to say, say it funny. If you have nothing to say, sing it. It makes it more fun to listen to the radio spots if you keep that in mind.
You know, that's an excellent point. So when we were talking about the Oxydol ad and how repetitive it was, some of the ad agencies in the 30s and 40s also made the same point. They said, you know what, people are going to be bored by all that repetitive, boring advertising. So really what we need to do is we need to make people laugh. So in the 30s, like in the Jack Benny show, he would say, when he was sponsored by Jell-O, he would say things like, Jell-O, again, it's Jack Benny. And I have a clip of Fred Allen, who was a top radio comedian, and he and his announcer, Harry Von Zell, do this little bit where they make fun of regular hard sell radio advertising. And the way they do it is instead of repeating the name of the product over and over again, ad nauseum, they forget the name of the sponsor.
Ah, very funny. Now, is this the Sal Hepatica?
Sal Hepatica was a laxative. And they're advertising it as some sort of curative potion. And it was Bristol-Myers product, and Bristol-Myers sponsored many of Fred Allen's programs. And Fred Allen's program was produced by the Young and Rubicam ad agency. And Young and Rubicam was a soft sell agency, and they really believed in not alienating the audience through, you know, advertising that, you know, hits you on the head.
Now let's take a listen to the clip.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Someone once said that the world stands aside to make way for the man who knows where he's going. And so tonight it gives me great pleasure to make way for a man who knows what he's talking about. Harry Von Zell.
Don't ever neglect the cold. At the very first sign of a cold, get after it immediately with the faster help of sparkling... what's the name?
Fred Allen, remember?
No. The name of the... I'm awfully sorry. I can't remember the name of what it is that helps fight cold faster. It slipped my mind.
Well, it'll come to you. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, yes.
Many physicians recommend it.
Yes. And it helps fight cold faster. But what is the name?
Well, here's a pretty to-do. Wait, Harry. There must be somebody around here who knows. If there is, will you please tell us confidentially? That's it. Sal Hepatica. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Well, that's at least you catch you're listening to it, and now I'll know Sal Hepatica.
Exactly. And this is also a way, too, by actually having the audience, give the name of the product. The listening audience then is laughing at the announcer forgetting the name, and of course they're repeating it in their own mind. Oh, well, of course it's Sal Hepatica. Well, of course it's Sal Hepatica. And this is a much more clever way of getting people to think about the product than in the Oxydol ad where 2 minutes into it they're spelling the name of the product over and over. They say O-X-Y-D-O-L, Oxydol, O-X-Y-D-O-L, because they're afraid that people won't hear it or understand it. And in this Fred Allen clip and in other shows that Young and Rubicam produced, other comedy programs like Jack Benny, this is the way of trying not to alienate the audience, and this is a way of entertaining an audience instead of annoying them with advertising.
We have a caller on the line, Sheila in Union Grove. Hi, Sheila.
Hello. How are you today?
Very good. I understand you remember W.C. Fields in a radio spot?
Yes, I don't so much remember him, but I remember, I think it was on WPR, hearing about, it was a show about him, and that he did a radio show, and I think it was sponsored by Lucky Strike. That part I'm not sure of. But he had a character in the show whose name was Chester Fields, and you put that together, it's Chester Fields, and the sponsor didn't get that for... quite a while. I think it was a couple of years. And I can't remember if they made him change the character or if they just let it go because it had been so long run. Do you know?
That's hilarious.
I know. He's so funny.
That is a great story.
Yeah, so Professor Myers was... Do you recall W.C. Fields making his character's name Chester Fields and a different cigarette company or brand was the sponsor?
I'm not familiar with that show, but I'm sure it was probably true. Lots of times a sponsor would be concerned if in the dialogue a word or a phrase came up that seemed to refer to another sponsor. So, for example, Lucky Strikes was owned by American Tobacco, and there was another tobacco company that told a radio scriptwriter not to use the word, not to use the word American, I think. I'm forgetting now the details, because they thought it would then, make people think about the other brand.
Yeah.
So it's very possible that he tried to slip that by them.
It seems as though that's an example, though, or at least that general example of how the advertiser does have control over content and how you might want to be a little concerned if an advertiser has so much control or influence over a program.
Yes, and in fact, this really becomes a problem, especially in the late 40s and early 50s. The political climate, in the Cold War, There's a Red Scare. And one of the things that happens is that a lot of people in the entertainment industry become blacklisted because of their political beliefs. And part of how this happened is that the advertisers and the sponsors, they were trying to build these positive associations with their products. And then if somebody accused a performer of having the wrong kind of political association, the advertisers, you know, panicked and didn't want this association. And the fact that they were controlling the programs through their ad agencies meant that they could just say, well, then we're not going to use you, you know. And the networks, by the way, were also deeply involved in this. CBS also had a blacklist, for example. But this was then a problem where because the program control was, you know, located in the advertising industry, as opposed to, like for a magazine or newspaper, you have the editorial side of the company, and then you have the advertising side of the company. And the people who run the editorial side, they get to decide what the stories are. And advertisers are not supposed to tell them what the stories are. But in the golden age of radio and in early television, the advertisers were deciding what the stories were. And this becomes very problematic. And then the networks themselves begin to realize that they like having the advertisers pay for the programming, but they realize that their lack of control meant that they were getting in trouble, too. So when people complained about a program, there were too many layers of responsibility. There was the ad agency, there was the producer, there was the performer, and the networks decided that they wanted to have control over programming. And so they started doing things in order to make that happen. They started producing their own programming. In fact, the Today Show and the Tonight Show were two of the first network-owned programs. And then they would just sell minutes of time between different segments. And that way, the advertisers just had to buy a minute of time instead of an hour or half an hour. And it was cheaper for the advertiser. And then it was easier for the advertiser because they weren't trying to figure out how to combine the entertainment and the advertising. The network figured out the entertainment, and then the advertiser just had to find the audience. So they would choose network programs based on what audience was watching, and they didn't have to worry so much about these associations and trying to come up with the exact right, you know, star for their show.
Interesting. We will continue talking about the evolution of advertising in broadcasting with our guest, who is the author of A Word from Our Sponsor, Admin, Advertising, and the Golden Age of Radio, talking about what advertisers did back then, how it changed, and how it is still present, or at least we can see some of its impact still today. And we welcome your questions and examples at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you have a question about the cultural impact of advertising in media, in broadcasting. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Right now we are talking about advertising, advertising during the golden age of radio, and how we are still hearing and seeing its influence today. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is Cynthia Myers, the author of A Word from Our Sponsor. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You know, we did get a call from John who wanted to know about political advertising and the content on radio today. He claims to listen to a lot of political radio, and he notices that the content that he hears in an advertisement is reflected in the content that he hears. I think he's listening to conservative talk radio. Cynthia Myers, is there a connection?
You know, I wouldn't know. However, it's often the case that advertisers seek a context or an adjacency that goes well with their message. So how it actually works on talk radio, I'm not familiar enough to say definitively, but I'm sure it's not a coincidence that advertisers and people who want to reach that audience are talking about some of the very same things that the people in the program are talking about. And this is one of the ideas behind sponsorship in general, was that you would have this kind of complete unit of program and advertisement that listeners could identify with and understand, and then keep that identification when they went out into the world. So in political radio, I'm sure there's a set of ideas that, you know, are being associated together. And in the golden age of radio, they were hoping that you would associate, you know, comedy with Jell-O or whatever it was, that there was some sort of commonality between the content and advertising. And advertisers don't want to be out of context, because that puts people off. That makes people feel negatively about them. So one of the things that advertisers like to do a lot is dissociate themselves with people that other people admire, like celebrities and movie stars. J. Walter Thompson was an agency that sold Lux soap using Hollywood movie stars like Joan Crawford. And then they also did a radio show where they did Hollywood movies as a radio program live with actual movie stars. And then there would always be an advertisement about how the movie stars used the product. So that was another way of for advertisers to make sure that listeners and audiences could have a good feeling about that product. Oh, if Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, you know, the top movie stars of the 40s, use Lux Flakes for their laundry, then maybe I want to use it too. You know, there's the contagion of celebrity that we all want to be like those celebrities, and we want to do things like them.
You know, I know we've talked about a soft sell, we've talked about a hard sell, we talked about some integrated advertising. There was also institutional advertising.
Institutional advertising is actually what we have mostly on public radio today. Institutional advertising is when the advertiser is not trying to sell a product, not trying to say, go out and buy this soap. But instead, what they're trying to do is they're trying to present a corporate image to remind people who they are, what they do, and they want people to have positive associations about them. So public radio is kind of based on a kind of sponsorship where a company will say, we're bringing this to you just to remind you, you know, who we are, but, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time, you know, telling you about our products, but we want you to make a positive association with us because we're bringing you programming that you value.
Yeah, just to, we do have underwriters, and you can call it advertisers, sponsors of public radio programming, but we have a limit on how long that announcement is. The spot is 15 seconds, and there can't be a call to action, or you can't say we're having a big sale, you know, or that kind of thing. It's really enough time to say that support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by business or organization or Corporation X, and that's about it.
Exactly. And one ad agency, BBDO, really specialized in this form of advertising in the 30s and 40s, and they produced, for DuPont Chemicals, they produced Cavalcade of America, and it was like a docudrama about episodes from American history, innovators, inventors, new technologies, and the program would be about an hour long, and they would spend about 5 minutes of it, which they thought was short, not by today's standards, talking about who they were as a company, how they had contributed to technological innovation, how they shared the same values as Americans in terms of, you know, progress, innovation. And one of their taglines was better things for better living through chemistry.
Well, let's take a listen to, we have an example of that.
For more than 130 years, almost as long as this nation has lived, the name of DuPont has been associated with this country's progress. So it seems appropriate that DuPont should have the privilege of presenting this series of episodes, taken truthfully from American history, to remind us that from the earliest days to the present time, the American people has stood for the staunch and simple qualities that form our heritage. A group of distinguished
educators... And that goes on for another minute or so, but...
And the way the sponsor thought of it at the time was that they were only getting 5 minutes out of 60 to get their message across, because the other 55 were devoted to the entertainment, which was, you know, a drama. But today, when we try to listen to some of these, they sound so long because we're accustomed to the 15 seconds, not the 5 minutes.
We're almost out of time, but now, of course, everybody's calling. Scott in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Scott. You remember a jingle, I understand.
Yeah, when I was growing up, and this would be about 40 years ago, here was a product that was called Sugar Bush. It was a soda, and it lasted only about a month. They had to recall it because the cans would literally explode when you opened them. They had some mix-up in their formula. So, but I was just amazed that here, 40 years later, on a product that only lasted that long, I still remember that it was like Sugar Bush, Sugar Bush, Sugar Bush, the drink that grows on trees. You know, and you get that for like about 1 week, and it was such a catchy little tune that I remember it after all these years.
Yeah, the jingle, Professor Myers?
Yes, actually there's a book out about jingles. It's called The Sound of Capitalism, and jingles really became popular in the 40s and 50s. When this huge industry arose just to write jingles. And a lot of the people who were writing them came out of the Broadway industry. And jingles were really important because, again, they put that earworm and kept people thinking about the product.
In less than a minute, Professor Myers, and I apologize, we have a caller who wants to know about advertising and new media, like podcasts or other online entertainment. Can you summarize in about 30 seconds?
Well, there's a big debate going on right now about how to finance programming today. And some people say it really should be advertising supported like the past. And there are a lot of advertisers who are now developing their own branded entertainment so that they're, you know, they're financing and controlling the entertainment. But there are a lot of other people who really think that a subscription model would work better, or a donation model, which the public radio system actually really succeeds at doing. So one of the things that's happening is that in terms of podcasting, people are trying to develop all of those models. And I think there's actually a lot of potential for new business models that don't depend on advertising, that actually are modeled more on public radio, where interested listeners...
We'll have to have you back to talk about the future of advertising. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.